It's 2 o'clock on the West Coast, and it's time now for a conversation with Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. What's on your mind this week, Elizabeth?
Well, Brad, on my mind this week are the closing of things and the opening of new opportunities. I'm coming to the end of our school year. I'm coming to the end of my formal job as a professor at Cal Poly. I'll be retiring. And yet it feels like kind of a bait and switch retiring because I'm going to come back when I'm retired to teach a couple of classes. But I am saying goodbye to my joy, my baby at Cal Poly, which is my family psych class. And tomorrow's my last lecture. So I'm already a little, I started crying at the end of class yesterday. So I'm a little bit choked up about it.
You're allowed to do that.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You really are.
So that's on my mind. My daughter, my baby, is turning 40 this week, which does not seem okay, but she's glorious, and we're going to be celebrating that. It feels like another big – this has been a year of transitions. As I mentioned last month, I turned 65. My other baby's turning 30. Just like we are all full into adulthood and sliding down the other side. of the arch. So those things are on my mind. The other thing that's on my mind is something else you might not know about Elizabeth. And we've been doing a few, let's get to know our radio host after 18 years of being here. I am the straightest person you'll ever meet, which always seems to surprise people given that my husband and I have been devout Grateful Dead fans our whole life.
This is my shocked face.
Thank you for your shocked face. So people assume and that, you know, I might be of the culture, but I'm not. I have been the straightest girl ever since high school, since the first time I dipped my toe into a few party things. I'm like, ooh, none of that goes well for me. And so it's always been an interesting thing because my students, and I'm looking at my intern, my students assume that I'm pretty cool, but my wardrobe belies how straight I am. And on many occasions, especially after Coachella weekends, I will get approached by students who will say to me, "Professor Barrett, I did mushrooms at Coachella and I'm still high. And can you help me come down off these drugs?" And the mom in me is like, "Oh my God, why are you telling me this?" The professor in me is like, "Oh, wow, that must be really uncomfortable for you." And the therapist in me is going, "Well, let's see how I can get you some help." And then I have had to use my secret network of clinicians on the Central Coast to find someone who can walk these students back down, because that is not my area at all. And there are anonymous numbers that I happen to have of people that can help people come down off their trip. All right. So that's something to know about Professor Barrett. And now my students who usually will come to me think, "Oh no, she's not a safe source." I'm an absolutely safe source. I just am not as cool as you think I am. Having said that, there is a lot of information and a lot of curiosity right now about the use of psychedelics and psychedelic therapies for mental health issues. And as I finished up the quarter, the last lecture I do in my clinical counseling class is about alternative therapies. And in my Mary Poppins-esque way, I talk about surf therapy and equine therapy and somatic therapies and expressive arts therapies and all of those alternative to talk therapies. And then I sneak in a John Oliver episode about psychedelic psychotherapy treatments, and then we have a conversation. And I don't have all of the answers for my students. It's not my area of expertise, but boy, the curiosity is there. And so I have a colleague at Cal Poly, Dr. Cody Place, who is beloved by students, and they talk about her constantly in my classes, especially if it's a question about drugs. And I'll say, "I don't know." And they'll go, "Well, Dr. Place in her class said." And so we're having Dr. Place on the show today to fill in a lot of my education gaps when it comes to the use of psychedelics for mental health care, and also just the whole world of drugs and psychoactive drugs and their place in our conversation, and about scheduling, because we had a recent signing of the president of an order about descheduling different drugs. Again, things I don't know everything about, but there's a lot of conversation, a lot of curiosity. And as always, there's a lot of concern because we don't have enough research, and no research could be perfect in actually dealing with something like psychedelics or psychoactive drugs. The best we can do is research, and share that information. And so we're going to talk about that today. The other piece of this conversation is how fabulously diverse Dr. Cody Place is. Because Dr. Place, one, wins over the students because they love to talk about drugs, but they also love the fact that Dr. Place was an FBI agent first.
Okay.
Yes, she has. She's a psychology professor specializing in criminology. Then she also has degrees in criminal justice, educational psychology, and applied management, and worked for the FBI. And she also has a whole side hustle talking about relationships and intimacy and how forming these meaning connections is so important. And therein lies my wheelhouse. So we kind of groove together on those two topics. But I love a professor of many passions, and I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about all the things she knows. I want to talk to her. So we're going to jump into our conversation. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can be part of the conversation today if you want to give us a call with any questions or comments at 805-781-3875. You can also find me after the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, or you can check out my website. There's a book on that website you might want to check out as well, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook. Send me a message there. And you can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And you can podcast our show wherever it is you find your podcast. Just search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, leave a review. That's always really helpful. And you can listen at your convenience. And you can share this conversation today and other past conversations with whoever you like. So that's where we are. We're going to take a quick break and get into our conversation with Dr. Cody Place right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Don't know what time it is. I've been up for way too long, and I'm too tired to sleep. I called my mother on the phone. She wasn't home. Now I'm wandering the street. I've been a fool, I've been cruel to myself. I've been hanging on to nothing, but nothing could be worse than hanging on. And something tells me there must be something better than all this.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Dr. Cody Place, thank you for coming to the show.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So this is our second time getting to have a conversation. The first time we focused a lot on psychoactive drugs, and today we were going to kind of move into the psychedelic treatments because those alternative therapies are so popular. But before we go there, I'd really like you to share a bit of your journey, because you have had so many interesting professions, including the FBI and being a psychology professor and relationship work. I'm curious, when, how you even started being curious about this and how you found your way here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So I started out with an interest in psychology, of course. I was really interested in learning, and that's kind of where educational psych came in. And then I just got really interested in kind of the criminal aspect and understanding, you know, those burning questions of, you know, many people have today about serial killers. Are they born? Are they made? And so that's kind of what led me to criminology. And then
I never ever was curious about those things, by the way.
Yeah, not all of us are.
I know. So what do you think drove that interest?
You know, I think when I was studying psychology, I always was interested in kind of the people who were set apart, the really unique people that we didn't necessarily understand very well, but that really had a deep impact on people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what led me down that dark path, but still an important path to kind of understand what leads people to these types of behaviors. And then, you know, I started my degree, my master's program in criminal justice, and I took a criminal profiling class, and I was kind of sold on just how impactful psychology could be. Mm-hmm. And that led me to be really interested in investigations.
Which, is that the forensic psych piece of it or different?
Yeah, no, that's really essentially forensic psych. Okay. There's many different facets of forensic psych, but the facet that I was most interested in was kind of that overlap with investigations and the essentially really looking at, can psychologists in any way help the field of law enforcement mm-hmm. when it comes to serial cases and things like that? And so for me, I did an internship actually with a county sheriff's department where I got to see kind of all the different things, investigations and patrol. And I was not interested at all in patrol. I so much respect and appreciate what they do, but not my skill set. And so they told me essentially, look at federal agencies if you just want to do investigations. And so that's what got me interested in the FBI. And yeah, I just was really, my students are always like, well, did you plan? I'm like, no, I didn't plan any of it. And that's a beautiful thing. Yes. You know, I have that conversation with students a lot and the importance of being open to opportunities that present themselves.
Be curious. Follow where your curiosities are.
Exactly.
So do you just fill out an application to join the FBI?
No. It's a really long mm-hmm. process. It took me about 2 years to process in. And so that you go through, obviously, a battery of testing, both like paper testing, physical tests, all sorts of interviews, and a ton of different. So it is definitely a long process. Mm-hmm. But I am so grateful for my time with the Bureau because it introduced me to many different things. I did not grow up around substances other than alcohol, you know, the kind of social normalized. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I had no exposure to that. And so it was really interesting, you know, to see the I mostly worked public corruption and financial crimes, so fraud and things like that.
The things we're not covering.
Exactly. Today. Exactly. but we did have a lot of agents. I worked at a small RA and we had a lot of agents who did, you know, work drug violations. And so that kind of started sparking my interest with substances. And then essentially, I also spent some time when I was at the FBI working for a group called the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group, which mm-hmm. is a mouthful, but mm-hmm. it's short. The HIG is what its short name is. And essentially, they are interested in evidence-based interviewing and interrogation practices. And so that kind of led me down the linguistic path of my current research of looking at reactants and how language impacts that, which interestingly coincides with psychoactive substances and looking at how people behave and speak and comprehend language when they are under the influence of substances. So it's a long and winding road, but I do have many passions.
It intersects, yeah. So going back to the interviewing, give me an example of like who would you be interrogating? What kind of – is that like a foreign, you know, agent or
– Yeah, so the HIG really did a lot of intelligence work like that. So mm-hmm. it would be, you know, somebody who potentially had information that might be helpful. But it really also broadens to, for me at least, in kind of my research and how it opened up of just how the language we're using in that to get the best information mm-hmm. because the HIG was established after the whole CIA waterboarding scandal that happened.
Okay.
And so it was kind of really, it was an executive order signed by Obama to really kind of show like, hey, evidence, we need to use research here, which mm-hmm. is why I really appreciated it so much. So a lot of that is around the intelligence community though, and kind of what, you know, information we can get to be proactive.
So did you have your PsyD in psychology when you went at the FBI or had you just done your master's? Like what was the...
Yeah, so I actually had just finished up my master's and was just starting on my PsyD when I first joined the Bureau. So that was actually kind of when I was finishing up and doing my dissertation. That was kind of one of the things that where I had to decide, you know, which path yes. am I going? And I developed a training for law enforcement. Essentially, it's really simple of say this, not that. And so I really wanted to test that. And so continuing to stay at the Bureau would not allow me to do that. So I left and I did end up testing my training. We wrapped up our study with Duke University PD. And it was really promising results. We just published our manuscript in January. So
it's still ongoing.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So it's really, again, how things intersect. You just never know until you kind of get in there and start messing around.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Cody Play, psychology professor at Cal Poly and an expert in many fields, starting with criminal justice and through linguistics and relationships and also psychoactive and psychedelic drugs. I mean, your classes, Cody, are legendary. The students always come out of them with so much to say and so much interest. And I'm curious about the study that you've done with Say This, Say Don't Say That. I would imagine that that information got more important after, like, the George Floyd incident and needing those. Are you seeing your trainings being put into action now?
Yeah, so I'm working really hard to get them out there and to, you know, approach agencies and get agencies who are receptive and who want to do this. But when I first kind of conceptualized this, I had no idea what the culture would shift to kind of around law enforcement and, you know, a lot of these really negative and harmful incidents we've seen. So it has kind of become twofold in a positive impact that I never planned or intended on. But it certainly is, you know, with the study we wrapped up, we saw increase in verbal de-escalation, which is, again, what we're hoping for. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of hopes. We still need to test it much more, but I do have a lot of hope because it is so simple. So if I can give you an example.
Yeah.
Anyone can say no to talking to law enforcement, right? So instead of walking up to you and saying, I need to ask you some questions, because that feels like, well, wait a minute.
An attack. Yes.
Exactly. So walking up and saying, you know, introducing themselves and saying, I know you may not want to answer some questions, but, you know, would you be willing to answer some? Or something like, I have some questions, feel free to say no. So reminding people that they have that autonomy. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge body of research in other areas, so social psych, health messaging, communications, that supports how our phrasing is really impactful. So it's, like I said, simple things of say this, not that. Mm-hmm. And I did many qualitative interviews as well along with this and got really positive feedback, as in, like, hey, this, I wish I learned this in the academy. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of trying to go down that road of hoping to get it implemented in early career so that they can build those kind of healthy communication strategies.
Well, and imagine how that branches out, because those communication skills are what we use in couples counseling. And so I'd imagine for officers to have that kind of training also improves their home life, because there tends to be high rates of abuse and assault in domestic issues in officers' lives. To have those skills would be a benefit in both directions, not just for the community, but in relationships.
Yeah, I actually had officers report that in the interviews, that they were using these strategies at home as well. Mm-hmm. And finding a lot of really promising results there as well. So again, it's not just about what the numbers say. Of course, that's an important piece, but it's about their lived experience of using these. Mm-hmm. And they're very low stakes, meaning they're not going to backfire. It's something worse is not going to happen if you use them. Mm-hmm, and so it's, again, it's an area that I think is so important, especially right now, to kind of really get that out there and hopefully have, you know, departments be receptive to it and want to learn how to just communicate better.
I also imagine that these skills, the de-escalation skills, would be helpful in the cultural divide in our communities as well, for how people can address each other when we have such divergent belief systems. And so I can imagine now that you're already thinking of, how do I incorporate these skills in community town halls? And
yeah, exactly. Because really it is about just, you know, how are we feeling mm-hmm. when someone is speaking to us, mm-hmm. right? And so, as you very well know, if we get really emotionally aroused, we are done listening. We yes. are done having productive conversations, and our amygdala is just driving the train. And so I think it's so important to also help people understand that and understand, wait a minute, if I feel this way, I can't communicate productively.
Exactly. Right. And to recognize that something shifts, because quite often people shift into their reptilian brain and it feels natural. because they go to that space so often.
Yep.
They don't recognize that they've shifted.
Exactly.
So until they get a better reaction from someone.
Exactly. And I think, again, you know, I'm a huge advocate of helping people understand their emotions, and obviously with my, you know, kind of the intimacy work that I do, but just mm-hmm. recognizing within your body, within yourself, your own internal signals, I think is something that cannot be understated. And I just think as a society, we don't do a great job of setting people up for success in that.
So we followed the path through the criminal justice and into the FBI, and how your FBI work kind of opened up into the linguistics work, which is yeah. also translated not just with the police force, but also with your work with intimacy and yeah. as a psychology professor and utilizing all those skills. And then you mentioned earlier when you were talking about the FBI, you were working with the drug enforcement piece as well. And if we talk about how our mind shifts under the influence, I would imagine it's even more challenging to tap into those linguistic skills we need to function. So I'm hoping that was a smooth way to move into how did your class about psychoactive drugs take form at Cal Poly? What was that more for the psychology of or the use of? Because that's what I'm always curious, because the kids act like we're getting some lessons on how to use these drugs.
Yeah, so essentially, I understand why they might portray that, because I approach the class very much from an informed decision place, because I am under the belief that people are going to use substances no matter what. We cannot policy our way out of substance use. And for me, a really important component is to have accurate information mm-hmm. and make those what I call informed decisions. Mm-hmm. So you need to have the information. You need to have your individual factors, because a lot of those are important as well. And so I do approach it very much in that way. We have conversations that are really open about controversial things, because we have, you know, honest conversations about questions and things that they maybe have been afraid to ask. You know, the very first day of class, I give them all a card and I tell them, you know, don't put your name on it, but I have them write a question that they've always wondered about psychoactive substances, but always been afraid to ask.
What are some of those questions?
Oh, goodness. I get everything from, like, what is the best drug? What is the worst drug? You know, what is, like, your favorite drug? You know, there's just a broad range of, you know, I heard that, you know, this drug does this or this drug does that. And it's just the amount of misinformation that I encounter in that class is just staggering.
Well, just as an aside, the amount of misinformation I encounter when I'm teaching sex ed in my class is also astounding. So the two also go hand in hand. When you have drugs and misinformation about sex ed, it makes it challenging to have healthy young people.
Exactly.
All right. So let's talk. I don't know where you'd like to start, but do you want to talk about the psychoactive drugs that are legalized and how, because I mentioned something about schedules and I don't really understand what that is. So maybe why don't we start there, that how are drugs decided which are okay and which are not in our society?
Yeah. So what we have essentially is the government in 1970 passed something called the Controlled Substances Act, and that created what's known as the DEA schedule. So what that is drugs that are considered to be essentially higher risk mm-hmm. are on that schedule. So we have...
Before that, there wasn't... Everything was legal?
So it's not everything was legal, but there was not a schedule to say, like, this is, like, more dangerous. And the schedule, what it really impacts is research, mm-hmm. Funding of research, ability to do research. And so right now, currently, Schedule 1 substances are considered to be the most dangerous. And I actually printed out from the DEA website, if I could read what mm-hmm. they say is a Schedule 1. Mm-hmm. So they say Schedule 1 drugs, substances or chemicals are defined as drugs with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. So that is what the schedule says. But the research paints a different picture for many substances.
What are some of the – what are Schedule 1s?
So Schedule 1s, marijuana is currently Schedule 1. Essentially all psychedelics except for ketamine are Schedule 1. Heroin is Schedule 1. So a lot of the kind of quote-unquote harder drugs that mm-hmm. people think are Schedule 1. And so the interesting thing with Schedule 1, though, is – if we take THC, for example, or cannabis, mm-hmm. THC is the main psychoactive cannabinoid, and there's a ton of medical research at this point. And so it's essentially policy hasn't quite caught up with the science yet. And so then if we take a substance like alcohol, for example, we talked a lot about alcohol in my last visit with you. Mm-hmm. And so alcohol is not on the schedule at all. It's legal.
Okay.
Which means that it's regulated, so you have to be 21, and there's certain rules and policies around it, but there's also purity standards. So you can go and buy alcohol, and you don't wonder what's in this alcohol. Is there a contaminant or something else? And that's where we really get some of the big concern, is that when substances are Schedule 1, then there's a black market for them. People are still going to do them, but people don't have access to pure forms of them. So they're taking them. And, you know, when I was at the Bureau and we would send drugs to the lab. And I mean, you cannot imagine the things that are in there, anything from rat poison to wasp poison to, of course, now fentanyl. And this is not fentanyl being created in a lab, right? This is fentanyl being created by someone who doesn't really know what they're doing. And so there's a lot of really dangerous contaminants in those drugs. And that's where a lot of the problems come in.
Would it make it safer to if they weren't Schedule 1 and they were legalized like alcohol then? Is that what you're saying?
So in my opinion, yes, mm-hmm. because what that would do is it would create a supply where people knew what they were putting in their body.
Mm-hmm.
So where it is now, people don't have that, and people kind of essentially what I call roll the dice mm-hmm. and decide. And of course, now we have, you know, testing strips and things, but they're not 100%. And so really it would drastically change things. And when we look at we work off a criminalization model here, meaning that drugs that are Schedule 1 are criminalized. So if you are possessing them, using them, selling them, manufacturing them, that is all illegal and you can go to jail. And so some jurisdictions have done something called decriminalization, and it's so important to understand that that's different than legalization.
Okay.
So decriminalization is kind of in the middle where they're trying to take the impact off the individual user. So if you use the substance, possess it, or buy it, then it's not legal. You still get fined or cited, but you don't go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now it's a certain, every substance has a different amount that you can have, and it's very nuanced. But then if you are selling or manufacturing under decrim, that's still illegal and you'll go to jail. Now legalization, like we talked about, right, is it's pure, it's regulated, there's policy around it. So a lot of people think that decriminalization and legalization are the same thing, and that's such a dangerous, because if we do decriminalization, it does move in the right direction as far as the criminal justice system side of removing some of that burden from substance users, but it doesn't create that pure supply.
It doesn't make it any safer or regulated.
No.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Dr. Cody Place, psychology professor at Cal Poly. Our number is 805-781-3875. And Matt, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for another great show. I just wanted to mention, and I'm sure that your guest talks about this in her course with her students, you know, not too many decades ago, especially psychedelics like mushrooms were used for alcoholism and all kinds of different things that could basically be given one dose to do, you know, help out so these people can face whatever their issues are and get past them, or end of life fears. And mm-hmm. there's a number of great documentaries about this, even on Netflix. And even back in, I think it was the 60s, it was either Life or Look magazine mm-hmm. had a on the cover talking about the effectiveness of the therapies of mushrooms. And, of course, there's very interesting documentaries also like DMT, the spirit molecule. And it's just a good time now because these things have such potential use as therapies that we need that more than ever, especially these days.
Absolutely, Matt. Thanks for bringing that up because I think that's the direction we're going with the show as to how do we see the use of psychedelics moving forward in our mental health treatments. Thanks for listening and calling in. Appreciate that.
Okay, thanks.
This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist, and we're going to dive into that the second half of the show. We're going to take a quick break now with Dr. Place, because that, I think, is the leading edge of all of our mental health therapies right now. As I said at the top of the show, it's what my students are asking about the most, moving away from SSRIs and antidepressants, and how do we have something that's right in front of us that'll be useful. You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We're going to take a quick break, come back, continue this conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Show some emotion. Put expression in your eyes. Light up if you're feeling happy. But if it's bad, then let those tears roll down.
Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist with my guest and colleague, Dr. Cody Place. All right. So Matt opened the door about the positive research that existed back in the 60s, and not just around mushrooms, but also LSD and some other substances. So can you bring us up to date with where we are with that research? And I, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I have students that are experimenting recreationally and using it medically at this point, but it's not legal. So what's happening?
Yes.
That was a big entrance.
Yes. So essentially, you know, there were many studies. I found over 1,000 peer-reviewed studies that had been published between the 1950s, 60s, up until the early 70s when that Controlled Substances Act was passed, and then essentially all the research was halted. And so what we saw in the early 2000s was that research starting to reemerge. And then really, I'd say in the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've really seen that come up. And what's a really interesting note is that they're actually replicating many of the studies that were done in the 60s with the same results. And for psilocybin especially, which is mushrooms, and for LSD. So using them to treat anything from depression, anxiety. Interestingly, you know, they're scheduled as highly addictive, but there's not literature to support that for the psychedelics.
So why did they get scheduled that way?
That's a complicated.
Okay, that's
it's
fine.
A complicated, nuanced thing. But a lot of it was social pressure, and there's many
it's
things.
Political. It's let's say that
it is. It's political.
Okay.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay.
So the science essentially is telling us, you know, we've seen promise, and there needs to be more research. I want to be clear that I'm not saying I think that psychedelics are for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I do think they need to be used under very controlled conditions. But there is so much promise there in giving people relief who have been suffering for a very long time. So especially with treatment-resistant depression, eating disorders, which are notoriously difficult to treat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. PTSD is a big one that's also very difficult to treat with, you know, historically with medications. And so there's anything from that to substance use disorders, especially alcoholism, but also nicotine and opioid use disorder. So they're really being studied the whole entire gamut, and again, really, really promising results for that. But it's important to note that all of these studies were done in a clinical setting, mm-hmm. and these people go through a protocol. So if I can speak for just a moment mm-hmm. about the importance of things like your environment and the people that you surround yourself with. The psychedelics are not like other substances where it's like you're at a party and it's like, oh, maybe I try this, maybe I don't. That does not set someone up for success at all, because your environment, your mental state when you're doing it, and also the people who are around you play a pivotal role in the experience that you will have. And in these clinical trials and clinical settings, there is a trained professional there. So if someone does start experiencing intense emotions or feeling panic, there's someone there that can help them. And that's really the adverse effects generally that we see, mm-hmm. Which is interesting as well. The psychedelics do not have generally negative side effects that are seen. Some of them do have some nausea and things of that nature. But as far as really significant side effects, the research is not showing those. So it's really interesting to kind of, again, take a substance that people are using in,
recreationally,
randomly all these different settings mm-hmm. and, you know, like at raves and concerts and things like that.
Right.
Those are really dangerous environments to be using psychedelic substances in due to the nature of psychedelic substances.
Well, wouldn't that be like recreationally taking Adderall and other prescription drugs as a off subscription or off prescription, right? I mean, similar to that.
Yeah, it's, and I'm not saying that, because I do believe also that there are people out there who do put in the time and effort to learn about psychedelics and they do have their own therapeutic protocol. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I don't think that exists, but I think the majority of people are kind of just making up their own thing or going in very uninformed. And that is a recipe for disaster with psychedelics more than other substances, just because of kind of how they work.
Two questions.
Yes.
One, how is the research being done if they're Schedule One drugs?
Yeah. So essentially, you can do research on Schedule One, but there are a significant number of barriers. So the first thing is you have to have what's called a Schedule One substance license from the DEA. Mm-hmm. It takes about 18 months to 2 years to obtain one of those. And the thing is, so let's say I was doing like three different psilocybin clinical trials, mm-hmm. right? I was studying that. I would have to have three separate licenses. So you don't get a license for each substance. It's for each trial. So it really creates a significant amount of extra work. So research is, as you know, a ton of work anyway. Mm-hmm. So in addition to the other steps you have to take, you also have to take additional steps to meet the criteria for that. And then there's also specific rules about how you store them. And like there are places who are unwilling to go through all that to do that. And so, you know, we're really seeing like Johns Hopkins and Stanford and Harvard and the big, you know, R1 universities, they're able to do that research because they have those resources. But another thing with Schedule One is usually federal funding is not available. And so like a lot of the work that gets done and research that gets done has to be funded through philanthropic means. Now, this executive order that got signed hopefully will change some of that funding. Nothing has actually changed yet, but hopefully it's a good signal that there might be some funding now for that.
So then does it run the risk once it's been researched? And I would imagine it's drug companies that fund most of the research that's done today anyway. Would they be then wanting the licensing of psilocybin to add to their antidepressant catalog? Is that where we're going? Well, is that the concern?
So I think that's where things get a little bit tricky because, you know, psilocybin is something that does naturally occur in nature. Mm-hmm. And so while there can be synthetic versions of it and things like that, so that might be an avenue that drug companies go down, but it's not as easy as something like Xanax, for example, right? To have the patent and be able to monopolize that and make money. So I think that that is honestly one of the things that is keeping psychedelics from really getting approval. MDMA, you know, in 2024, they submitted a, you know, new drug application for that after it had done 20 years of clinical trials and it got denied.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was widely thought that it would be approved, but it was denied. And it wasn't a full rejection of like, this is never happening. It was, you need to do more work. But some of the reasoning they gave was a little bit questionable given some of the other things, you know, like OxyContin, there was a whole problem with that and they didn't really regulate that well. So it's just a really inconsistent.
It's almost like every drug that's side effect can be euphoria is considered dangerous. Anything that has a potential for joy, like LSD or psilocybin or MDMA, the party drugs. And that I find that interesting, that the cutoff of anything that has to do with human pleasure in that regulation in our government is very interesting to me. And then alcohol, which has no guardrails around it. Every research study that's come out for the last 5 years, almost in, you know, the tandem with what's coming out with psilocybin, then the alcohol research is damning of that. So where are we?
It's really challenging. My students have a lot of those same questions because I do spend a fair amount of time talking about alcohol, and we have a whole entire list, a short truncated list on the negative impacts of alcohol, which none of them want to hear.
No, they do not.
But they listen and ask a lot of good questions. But yeah, when we're talking physical impacts of alcohol, when we're talking social impacts of alcohol, when we're talking economic impacts, alcohol is by far the most expensive substance there is. But it's so normalized that it's really hard to kind of pull that back while pushing other things that, you know, if we just looked at the science in and of itself, purely science, to decide the schedule, alcohol would most certainly be scheduled because of the high addiction potential, all of the negative impacts, health impacts, all the, you know, probability of violent behavior, like all of the things that the research has said.
Yes.
But again, the schedule isn't necessarily just aligned with that. So it is very confusing for a lot of people as to how one thing is legal and you can just go down and get it anywhere. And it's really...
We have a culture of establishments built on the culture of alcohol. So
yeah,
it's steeped in the stories.
Yeah. And there's no... I have not... Again, I haven't read every study, but there's not one single study that I am aware of that talks about any kind of medicinal benefits of alcohol.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Dr. Cody Place, psychology professor specializing in criminology and also degrees in criminal justice, educational psychology, applied management. Dr. Place is a beloved professor at Cal Poly and teaches a highly popular class about the effects, behavioral effects of psychoactive drugs. Whoa, sorry about that. That was my phone. Don't call me, child. There we go. I want to talk about cannabis and marijuana a little bit also, because where is that on the schedule?
So currently it's Schedule 1.
Okay.
Federally. That's because the schedule is for federal regulation.
Although it is legalized in many states. Let me finish. What about the research of the psychotic episodes related to cannabis use? Your turn.
So that's also complicated because a lot of the research is, so the potency of THC that people are consuming now is significantly higher than it has ever been historically.
So it's not regulated then, even though it's legalized?
No, it is regulated, but there's no upper limit, just like with alcohol, right? You can get anything from a beer that has, you know, 3, 4, or 5% alcohol to a hard liquor that has significantly higher percent of alcohol. Just those potent forms were not available previously, because now that cannabis has become an industry in many states, then it's driven by money and profits. And so here we see, you know, the introduction of things like, I think they're called dab pens. I don't, my students tell me about it, but they're, they're a really high potency, like 98% potency THC. And so we don't even those are so new. We don't even have research on the implications of those really potent forms. But we do know that THC itself has been used for thousands of years. But now we're seeing a lot of problems, which, again, for me, based on what I know, leads to the potency is a problem. And we need to have that conversation of that. So I think that psychedelics share that with potential for psychosis or psychotic symptoms mm-hmm. in vulnerable individuals. So again, genetics is not my specialization whatsoever, but it is complicated. And so it's multiple different genes with multiple different markers. Will something express itself or not? And so if someone does have, you know, a family history of schizophrenia or bipolar one, both THC and psychedelics should be like used very cautiously if they do decide to partake in that.
So where, I'm not sure which is the question, but where do you see the mental health promise for the psychedelics? Because one of the other things that is emerging in the last 5-10 years is the minimal benefits of the long-term use of SSRIs and other antidepressants and antipsychotics, that they lose their potency and people end up taking 4, 5, or 6 drugs and none of them are doing what they're supposed to do anymore. And yet when people try to stop taking these drugs, they have side effects and symptoms that are far worse than what put them on the drugs to begin with. So, and this is a lofty question, but what do we do with this information? Because those drugs were considered to be the savior of depression and anxiety, and yet now we're seeing so many long-term issues. What's the promise of the psychedelics, and what do you will it replace the antidepressants and anxiety meds?
You know,
and can they and should they?
That is definitely a big question that I don't have a straightforward answer to, but I do have what I'll call an informed opinion on that I would happily share. So number one, it's not going to work for everyone. Just like, you know, the antidepressants and SSRIs and different things don't work for everyone. Psychedelics are not for everyone and they're not going to work for everyone. But the beautiful thing about them is the people they do work for, they really work for. And so I actually pulled some quotes from some research studies of participants, what they had said. And so this will hopefully give you a little, as a therapist, I'm sure you'll be like, wow.
Always curious.
Yeah. So this was specifically for MDMA assisted therapy for PTSD, which, as you know, notoriously difficult to treat. So some quotes were, "I don't hate myself anymore. I finally forgave myself. I stopped being afraid. I felt connected again." Like, these are things that, you know, this one is really impactful as well. "The trauma happened to me, but it isn't me." So being able to really face trauma in a way that is not possible without that assistance. Because essentially what psychedelics do is they allow people to be more open. They create essentially something called neuroplasticity in our brain, which is how we build new neural networks. So many of those networks that just aren't serving us anymore, we're able to overcome those, right? With psychedelics, these people are able to rebuild healthy neural networks. And the other benefit is, you know, somebody might do like 1 or 2 trips the rest of their entire life. And this isn't something you take every day. This is something that you're doing, again, very intentionally, therapeutically, 1 or 2 and then you're good. And
which is amazing.
It's, well, it really is. And again, it's not, that's not, not everyone is going to have that. But I think for me, the biggest thing is I believe that there is enough promise here and enough research to say we know these are the risks. And if someone has tried everything else and they want to do this, I believe it should be available to them because there are so many people suffering that cannot find relief. And if we have something that is beneficial. Again, there needs to be more research, but we have a large body of research currently.
Well, as you said, the studies from the 50s and 60s are being replicated today. So what was true then has continued to be true.
Yes. So it's really profoundly life-changing. And, you know, the caller brought up different documentaries, and there's a really great one based on Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. Mm-hmm. So if people are interested in psychedelics, I would really encourage them to watch that because it does a great job of educating in an entertaining way. I understand I'm a professor, so it's like,
yes.
But it's, you know, it is a very interesting way that it's done. And in the MDMA episode, it really got me because there's a veteran who talks about how after he did his experience that he went the first time in 8 years without thinking about killing himself. That's profoundly life-changing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just think, again, there's so much promise. Again, when done safely, clinically, all of that, but just immense promise.
So how do people find those clinicians that are doing these trips? You know, I know that California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco is certifying people in psychedelic treatments. They're certifying people, but how does the regular person, how are they, one, getting the experience to know that they're doing the right thing, and two, where are people to find these guides?
It gets really complicated, and that's where, unfortunately, it gets kind of scary because places are certifying and giving these credentials when, again, there's really not any body overseeing that because, again, federally, it still is Schedule I, meaning it is illegal. Mm-hmm. But then there are two states, Oregon and Colorado, both have set up programs for psilocybin, assisted therapy, essentially. And so California has not done that as a whole. And so it's really, you've got to use a lot of caution in anyone who's claiming to be certified. A lot of this is, again, it's not, I'm not saying it's people who don't have experience using them, but it's not people who have clinical training. And so you've got to just be very cautious in that. So right now, unfortunately, there's not like an excellent way to find someone. Mm-hmm. But I would really recommend people just do a lot of research on different substances and, you know, have conversations with people. That's why I tell my students.
Well, and yeah, I think finding a good clinician, whether it's talk therapy or expressive arts or in psychedelic, that always is part of the process because at the end of the day, all of the oversight of training and clinicians is not great. I just want to say overall. Mm-hmm. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. We have time for one more quick call and we're going to go out to Laura in Morro Bay. Laura, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Thanks, Elizabeth. Always a good show.
Thanks.
Wondering if there's a possibility that a person could overdose on cannabis. And the reason I ask is that my younger sister imbibes in between 50 and 75 milligrams a day through edible. And I'm quite concerned about her mental health as well as her physiological health and the possibility of ODing.
Thank you. I appreciate the question. What do you say, Dr. Place?
So as far as, again, it depends on is she mixing it with other things, but as far as cannabis itself, there has not been any recorded overdoses for cannabis itself. So again, if you're mixing it with different substances, it becomes a problem. But as far as like actually toxicology overdose, no, as far as we know. Again, that's reported, though, so we mm-hmm. don't know. But I would say it's extremely low, especially compared to other substances.
But as you mentioned before, there isn't regulation about what's getting mixed in, like what people are buying, the cannabis they're buying, or is it regulated?
It is regulated okay. in California.
Okay.
So assuming this
so the
is in California.
Level is safe.
It's just like alcohol. Mm. It's just that the potency, there's not like an upper end where it's like you can't get something that's X potent. Okay. But it is regulated.
Does that help, Laura?
It does, but she's in the state of Arizona, so I don't know if regulation is crucial there or not.
You know, I don't know Arizona's laws that well, but if Arizona has legalized it, because every state can legalize. So if Arizona has legalized, then, and she's getting it from, again, that's another
piece.
Yeah, yes. She's getting it from a dispensary. Then I would say I would not have concerns about the purity of it.
All right. Laura, thank you
great.
For calling. We appreciate you giving us a call. All right. So, Dr. Place, the hour goes too fast, and I want to give you a couple minutes. If all of your students were listening right now, what are the things you want them to know about this drug culture that we live in?
Be critical consumers of information. And what I mean by that is fact check things you hear. Social media runs rampant with all sorts of different things. So,
do you think social media runs more rampant in the positive use or the negative?
You know, I myself don't do social media, so it's hard to say. I hear a lot of negative things from students saying that. I think really where I see it negatively is perpetuating misinformation. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, again, informing yourself, whatever substance it is you want to engage with, just learning about it and not just blindly going in and making that decision on a whim, whether that be caffeine, because caffeine's a psychoactive drug, or whether that be psychedelics. I think regardless, it's so important to spend some time to learn about substances and not just believe everything you hear, because now it's a mess.
And it is so challenging because we're at a time where the trust and faith in science and government and regulatory bodies is so low, in some ways rightly so, that it feels almost more dangerous to trust any information that we're getting that's going to impact our mental health or physical health and well-being, which is a shame because, as you said, for the people that are getting relief, it is life-saving to
yes.
not feel suicidal or depressed to the point of not getting out of bed. It's heartbreaking that we don't have a stronger sense of truth around this subject.
I could not agree more. And hopefully one day we're moving in that direction.
Thank you, Cody, for coming and spending an hour with me.
Yes, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook to send me a message, or send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can also podcast our show, Spotify, NPR Podcast, wherever you find yours. And please subscribe and share it with friends so we can build our audience. As always, thank you for tuning in, listening, and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Ain't nobody just like this. I gotta be me, baby, hit or miss. Sitting here all by myself, trying to be everybody else. Can't you see? Yeah, I gotta be me. Just like this, I gotta be me. Baby, hit or miss. Look at you sitting there, all by yourself, listening to everybody, everybody say, be everybody else. Can't you see? Oh, you gotta be the. Hit or miss. Oh my la 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 la. Oh, you see, I gotta be me. Be me, oh, baby, hit or miss. Sitting here, I'm all by myself. I'm trying to be everybody else, but now I see. I gotta be me. Ain't nobody just like this. I gotta be me. Baby, hit or miss. Baby, hit or miss. Hit or miss.